Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is Glenn Klein online for Wednesday, December 6, 2006. The only December 6, 2006 in the history of humanity. Let us continue to choose to make it a great one. It's all a matter of attitude, ladies and gentlemen. We used to say in the Word of Faith movement, and it's still applicable today, your attitude will determine your altitude or how high you go. Truer words have never been spoken, have they, Michael?
None truer.
Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Glenn Klein online webcast, the president of the Gospel Revolution, Mr. Michael Williams. Michael, a week goes by quickly. It's good to have you back online, my friend.
So fast. It does go by. It seems like we were here just yesterday.
Well, for a lot of folks who may not have been listening live, all of our webcasts are archived at glennklineonline.com. Let's see how many we've done so far.
So you're saying for them it can be just yesterday.
Exactly. It could have been just an hour ago.
Just an hour ago.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We've done 8 of these webcasts already. And we're just getting going, ladies and gentlemen. We want your involvement as well. You can email us your comments or questions tonight at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. That's webcast@gospelrevolution.com. We ask, as always, that you keep your comments brief and let us know where you're writing from, because it is very encouraging to us and to all those that are logging on and listening to know that people of like mind and like faith are getting involved and in agreement all over the world. It's an amazing thing, Michael, that we've heard over these last couple of months from people as far away as Australia and the Philippines and the Caribbean, Germany. This message is truly a message that any human being can, if they can get their mind around it, it's going to benefit them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's just the ones that we hear from. There's, you know, I have personal knowledge of the tapes being translated actually into Chinese and smuggled into communist China.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I know. It was that story is one that I will never, ever, ever forget. One of the, let me tell it. One of the, up in Canada, I was sharing with a group of that had embraced the gospel, and it was a group of senior citizens, and there was a gentleman there who that came there from Africa, and he was from the Zulu tribe and was a man who had been converted, and of course all the churches in Canada in that area, they wanted a convert from the Zulu tribe in Africa speaking in their churches. And as he was speaking, he was informed by some local pastors that a group of senior citizens had been deceived by this man teaching on grace. And so, being a compassionate man, he decided he wanted to help out. And he went to this group of seniors and asked them in Alberta, southern Alberta, and asked them if he could come and sit in on their Monday night session where they listened to a Mike Williams tape, because he wanted to help them see the error of their way. And at first they wouldn't let him come because he said some not so nice things about me and the gospel that I was sharing. And these folks were in their 70s and 80s, and you get to that age, you just get to say whatever you want.
Right.
And they just told him, says, you can't come. It's our home. You know, you said bad things about Brother Mike, and you said bad things about the gospel, so no. So he finally agreed that he wouldn't say anything bad, so he came to the sessions, and he stepped through the first and the second Monday, and I think on the third one he raised his hand and asked if he could speak, and they said, yes, if you're not going to say anything bad about Brother Mike or the gospel, you can say something. And he thanked them, and he said, if you had not welcomed me into your home, I would have never had the privilege of hearing the gospel of Jesus Christ for the first time in my life.
That's awesome.
And what no one knew was that he was on his way to China and had already been to China and was accepted teacher from Africa, and almost without any restrictions came and went into communist China. And he loaded up a box of tapes and took them there and had them translated and was passing them out throughout in the area of China where he was.
You know, we see the so-called worldwide ministries reaching out into places like China, and they are being run by the people that we see on TV, and some, of course, we don't see, but these large mega churches have these outreaches, and they are for the express purpose of spreading a message that is enriching the people at the top of the totem pole.
Yeah.
In this case, this guy just took it upon himself to spend his own money, take his own life at risk, and I mean, that's somehow I see a little bit of a difference there.
There's a little bit of difference, and you know, of course, I remember all of our days in evangelical Christianity and the promptings and the proddings and the threats even about going out and sharing this. I remember one teacher coming through, and he just told us that, you know, that God's plan was 2x2, and if you didn't lead at least one person to Jesus, you wouldn't get into heaven unless you had somebody else to bring with you. And so, I mean, that's how extreme it was. But without any prodding, the wonderful thing about the gospel, you know, I'm even tired of saying the gospel we share because I just believe it's the gospel.
But it is true. It's the gospel we share.
It is the gospel we share, and which is the gospel.
Right.
And it's like you can't keep these folks' mouths shut. I mean, it's like the ones listening to us now. You know, their greatest problem is keeping their mouths shut. It's not trying to get it open. So there is a difference.
And it's also a timing thing. You know, I have shared the gospel now for the better part of 10 years. And sometimes you're talking to somebody, even if they have a church background, and they get that Migo look. You know what the Migo look is?
No, you got me, Glenn.
My eyes glaze over.
Okay.
And it's like they're just not ready to hear it. But then there are other people, and obviously the ones that write, the ones that follow the website, they are ripe. They are ready for freedom. And our first letter tonight is coming from Daphne, Alabama. He says, "Hey, Mike, I'm sure you do not remember me at all, but I have had the opportunity to be in your services several years ago. Anyway, he says his name is Gene, and he attended Life Church in Alabama, where Bill and Mary Anderson were pastors. And he says he played the piano at the church for praise and worship services. Anyway, I am one of those guys that you helped try to cast the demon out of. And honestly, Mike, your letter that you wrote on your website meant more to me than you will ever know. He said, I have struggled with homosexuality for years and years and years, as far back as elementary school. And like you, I was brought up in a church that condemned this lifestyle to the nth degree. I just always felt it was no help for me at all. And then you came along and tried to help me, but I quickly came to realize that there was no need for any help for me at all, and that this is who I am, and I've accepted it." And he goes on in his letter to say how much your letter meant to him, Michael. And the one thing he says in here that Gene from Alabama says is how much he misses church. Of course, there's no church, or very few churches, especially in L.A., that would be lower Alabama, where a person like this, there are obviously gay-friendly churches, but as we were talking about before the webcast, even they are stuck in legalism.
Yes, and, you know, just to comb a point here to show that all of our webcasts are completely unrehearsed. I don't know what questions are going to come flying at me. And that is that what you don't know is that since that letter came in, I have talked with Gene on the phone. I was so excited to get the email and also from another lady who went to that church years ago when I spoke there. And one of the most heartbreaking things that I remembered was that because of my testimony that Gene, who was playing the organ and the piano, the keyboard, he's a very, very talented man, because of my testimony, he was kicked out of the church.
Well, let's remind people of what that testimony was for people who
Well, my testimony was that of an ex-gay, that I had been delivered from homosexuality, and that that was my standard of righteousness. I'm so grateful to have found that the standard of my righteousness is Jesus. It's not my sexuality, one way or the other. But Gene had listened to that. Actually, Gene had attempted desperately to follow in my footsteps. And as I said in the letter, that Gene, like many others, were just simply able to be more honest than myself at the time. And the amazing thing, let me just say this. Here is a man. You talk about graciousness and God being in somebody. Here's a man that, because of what I had said and done, that he was ostracized, and yet he has expressed nothing toward me in finding me again. He has expressed nothing toward me except incredible, incredible grace, and tells me, he said, "Mike, I wouldn't walk across the street to go to most churches, but I would give anything to sit in another one of your sessions." These are experiences that are very personal to my heart, and Gene's letter was a very personal one to me and to my own heart and to my own walk, because Gene was one of those many thousands who were affected by my misconception that my righteousness was based in my sexuality. And here, even though he had been rejected by that church, much because of the information of my stance, of my standard, of my righteousness that I had, and yet here, after all of these years, and I'm telling you, it's been years, that I have the privilege of hearing back from this man, and he's in a good, stable relationship. He's been with the same person for many years now. And I hope they're listening, and, I salute them. My goodness, what an example of true godliness that is not expressed in what someone's sexuality is, but just in kindness. My goodness. The sad thing is that most people we would consider ungodly can be some of the kindest people on the face of the earth. But Gene's letter to me and his response when I made contact with him via email, and then later we spoke by phone, was just nothing but the grace that I preach and that I teach. And I really do hope, Glenn, that those who were affected by the ministry that I had in times past, as Paul would have put it.
Right.
I can only hope that their understanding of where I was and the stand I made, because of my own fear of hell and my own fear of losing my salvation and angry and wrathful God, that they would all understand, as Gene has. I've actually been in contact with a couple of others in the last few weeks, and one of them was still angry with me, and I made contact with that person too, and I told them, goodness, there's nobody in the world who understands why you would still be angry. But all it took was me admitting that I was wrong, and it was all over with. And he said he was able to put 25 years of pain away and begin to resolve it. I don't know that he's resolved it completely, but began to have a healing process, because I was able to say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." And in my former doctrine, I could have never said, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." But today, I'm just so grateful that my righteousness is based in Christ and not in my performance, to where that saying "I'm sorry" and saying "I was wrong" is not an indication as to whether or not I am right with God or not. When you know that you're right with God, be because of some other means other than yourself, then being gracious and being able to admit I was wrong is not such a big deal anymore.
You know, that when you were preaching, I was gay, but God delivered me, that was like in the 70s.
'70s and into the 80s, and began at least softening it because I was coming to understand things better, but not able to incorporate it even into the early part of the 90s.
And at that time, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, you were like the first man to stand up behind a pulpit and say, I was gay, but God delivered me, and now I'm not gay anymore.
I was the first one on a national and international basis to do that. Yes, that's absolutely true.
Now, out of that spawned the entire ex-gay ministry movement, which is now, I mean, taken off to such a degree. There must be a lot of gay Christians out there for there to be such an outreach that has been so impacting, and I mean, it's widespread. And I was involved when I was in evangelical Christianity, and my particular sphere of influence was in charismatic and messianic Judaism. I tried to stop the encroachment of the so-called gay rights movement in the camping industry. I was a camp owner. And when I finally came out of the legalistic system and understood that our righteousness was not in who we were sleeping with, but who had died for us, I was able to go back and apologize to my colleagues in the camping community and say, I was wrong. This was wrong. And they were a little shocked because I was so vehement about the importance of stopping the influence of the gay community in youth camping. And yet, it was so cathartic to be able to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. And we can kind of relate to where, remember, Paul, ladies and gentlemen, was killing Christians, killing them. And so at some point, Saul, he repented too, didn't he? And we can kind of relate to where he was at, you know, having killed people for having faith in Christ and then having come around and say, no, that was my past ministry. that was a heck of a ministry to have to repent from.
Yes, absolutely. And even my ex-gay statements did cost people their lives. And because in a few cases, thank God, not in a multitude that I know of, but in many cases, there were young people who went through the process that I went through, that I claimed to be ex-gay, and they, being able at the time to be more honest than myself, accepted the fact that there was no change that took place. And because of the standard that I set, I do know of at least a handful of them who took their lives, because to them, because see, this is the danger of self-righteousness and setting up that my life is a standard of righteousness before God. Because when you declare that, then you set other people trying to meet your standard. And those who do not achieve your standard for whatever reason, then they accept that as a rejection from God because they cannot become what you are. They can't do what you do. And that is the deadly thing about self-righteousness. At least one of the deadly things, my goodness, I don't think I could go through all the deadly things about self-righteousness, but one of them certainly is, Glenn, setting a standard, which is not true in the first place. I don't care who you've listened to who said that they are righteous before God because they quit this, started that, didn't do this, and don't do that.
Michael,
it simply is a lie.
We're having a little bit of technical difficulties. We have to pause for 5 seconds, and we will be right back on Glenn Klein Online. All right, we're back in Glenn Klein Online. For those of you who lost us there momentarily, just know that the last few minutes will be on the archive when we go back from there. But Michael, when we got interrupted there, we were talking about self-righteousness and how somebody that stands up before them and justifies their righteousness in front of God based on something that they did do that they aren't doing anymore or are doing that they weren't doing, that's no good.
It's not only no good, it's deadly. It can be, and in my case, when I stood up and declared that my righteousness before God, that I was now right with God because I was no longer gay, that set a standard that people who had a heart toward God used that standard to determine now whether or not God had accepted them or not. And it cost people their lives, Glenn.
How do you deal with that emotionally?
Well, I tell you, when it first happened, I was in Philadelphia, and I will never forget it. I collapsed to the floor, and I cried my guts out for 3 hours. I mean, literally, if you can imagine the most extreme point you've ever cried and do that for 3 hours, that's what happened that day. Several years after that, that happened about once a month, and it was, once every 3 months, once every 6 months. I don't know that you ever get past the reality that your words and something that you so fervently adhere to, trying your best to get your own way to heaven, and find and make sure that you were going to heaven, that in the past that you had thrown so many people into darkness, I mean mentally and emotionally. And I don't know that one ever gets past that. It just becomes a part of you. It becomes a reality that is just something that you accept. And the thing that I'm grateful to know is that those people who were affected by such drastic things, even though it may have been, maybe part or all of what I said that led to those ends, at least I know that their end result was not one that was predicted by the church, at least.
Or what they thought was going to happen to them.
Or even what they thought was going to happen.
I would have liked to have seen their surprise when those people who, took their lives because they were so frustrated with not being able to get freed from this particular quote-unquote demon, passes from this life to eternity, however that transpires, and are in the presence and the glory of God.
Yes, absolutely. And as it is with any picture, the big picture sometimes can be more comforting than focusing in on one part of it, for sure.
Well, we've got a real good question kind of in the same vein. This is from Paul in the United Kingdom. He says, "We believe that all people will go to heaven when they die. Why do you think God created us as physical beings first living on earth? In other words, what is the purpose of this very temporal physical life?" That's Paul from the UK.
You know, those things are bigger than me, Paul. there's a lot of answers out there. There's a lot of people saying that God created us for His pleasure. There's verses of Scripture to indicate as such. But the only thing that I know is that this is us, and this is the way it is. And even if we figured it out, I don't know that it would help us in the process any. But I can be very honest with you and tell you that I don't know.
Right, and that comes under the category of your famous quote, "Why is the only question that blinds the eye?"
Yeah.
The question really, I mean, there's no answer to it.
Yes, that one, there is no answer. And the only thing that we can do, and of course I know that there's some theologians that could give you a great in-depth, detailed description as to why. But, a lot of life becomes livable when we embrace that we don't know all the answers. Having answers is a wonderful thing. But sometimes I think, Glenn, that accepting the fact that there are no answers to some questions is the greatest peace that we can have in life.
It's a great point. And you know, one of the names of God in the Bible is Shalom, which of course in Hebrew means peace. And ultimately, the answer to why God did it the way he did it this way is because Shalom, peace,
yes.
God. That's why he did it. We have absolutely no idea, but it's nice to think about these things. And it's also nice, Michael, to have the freedom to talk about them and say, we don't know why. We had answers back in the church. The reason was that God wanted to have a group of people that would choose to accept Christ, would choose righteousness, would choose to worship him. But now we're just stuck with the fact that apparently God wants a lot of people in fellowship with him, and we believe that encompasses everybody from Adam and Eve to those that are being born as we speak. Frankly, those that are being conceived as we speak. That's a lot of folk.
A lot of them, but still not as many as the stars of the sky or the sands of the sea. And there will never be as many humans on this earth as there are stars in the sky or sands in the sea, which was the revelation that God gave Abraham as to how many people would be included in this covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he when Abraham asked God, how many people can I depend on being a part of this covenant? And he said, when you're able to number the stars of the skies and count the number of those sand granules in the sea, then you'll know.
That's a lot of folk.
A lot of folk.
That includes
considering
everybody.
Considering that the Milky Way alone still holds more stars, vastly multiplied over the number of humans that have ever been on the face of planet Earth to this day.
Ryan from New Jersey writes, and he says that a couple of weeks ago, Michael, you mentioned on the webcast that you're a creationist. And he said that he's been wondering about this for a long time, raised in Catholicism. He said that God made Adam and Eve, and they had two sons, Cain and Abel. Then Cain kills Abel. But nowhere does it mention any daughters that Adam and Eve created. So where did all the other people come from?
Well, that's the thing about the Old Testament. It is basically fairly negligent to women, not only in creation or reproduction of the first ones, but none of the descendants when you read the genealogy, you know, it's the seed. It's the male that is the one that is counted. So just because they weren't counted doesn't mean they weren't there. You know, and again, this is one of those questions that unless we are able to look at the situation which was at hand at the time. Now, we now view these things such as a brother and a sister conceiving as just, you know, that's not only not right, it's not healthy, you know. But I don't know. But I do know that things were drastically different during that time. And all the way up until the flood, I mean, there was tremendous differences about the way human beings lived and were able to live and the length of time that they lived. All of that was completely different.
And recently there's some scientific evidence that all of humanity's DNA came from an original couple. Even the scientific community is getting in line with that concept.
Yes, absolutely. That is true. And, you know, just because it doesn't work today doesn't mean it didn't work then. And just because there is no record of the females that were born to Adam and Eve, obviously there were females that were born to them. And even though it is now inconceivable that someone would conceive or bring forth another child by their brother or by their sister
or by their mother,
yes, it's not. It was not inconceivable at that time.
And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, the whole concept of the birth of Christ is that God, the Almighty, had some sort of sexual encounter with a 13-year-old virgin. That would not, that be, what would Jesus do? What would the Father do? He would have sex with a 13-year-old virgin. We wouldn't necessarily recommend that as a course of action based on the Bible story. But that's what the, that's what it says.
Yes, well, of course, we know that there was no sexual intercourse that took place, but there was definitely the seed was there by some concept, but that is the way that it took place. But by sexual intercourse, that we don't know.
No, and we wouldn't assume that again because it doesn't say that. But
no, it doesn't.
God the Father impregnated a 13-year-old virgin.
Yes, bottom now line. That we do know. Yes.
Yeah, and thank God for it.
Yes, we're grateful.
This is Glenn Klein Online, along with Mike Williams of GospelRevolution.com. We invite you folks to email us your questions. We have gotten our technical difficulties all squared away, thanks to our producer and engineer, Patrick L. Jones. Very thankful for all his help, as always. And for those of you who dropped out there for a while, we continued recording the conversation, so at some point you'll want to go back to the archives and listen to that 5 or 10 minutes that the server went down. But we are taking your questions this evening at webcast@gospelrevolution.com, webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Sometimes, Michael, people just write with just such thankfulness. Here's a letter that comes from George Howell, and he says, Mike, it was quite a surprise when I answered the phone, and you were there. As I told you, I would no longer go 10 feet to hear any other man, but I would to hear you speak of the gospel of grace and peace that Paul preached. I wanted to thank you and Glenn for this webcast and also wanted to encourage others to consider giving some to you this holiday season. That's a good point, and thank you very much, George, for mentioning that. We need your support, ladies and gentlemen. This is not free. Freedom is not free. And certainly the proclamation of the gospel is not free. We need your help. You can go to gospelrevolution.com, order teaching series, make donations. We're looking for people who want to sponsor an entire webcast. For $250, you can sponsor an entire webcast dedicated to whatever cause or anniversary or celebration that you would like. Just email us and let us know you want to do that at webcast@gospelrevolution.com. Here's a question, Michael, from Mike, who is writing. He doesn't say where he's writing from. Please do include that, folks, when you do write so we know where you're listening from. But he said, Mike, could you succinctly explain the difference between redemption and salvation? I'm having a hard time with a few people, legalistic evangelicals, he says, and one atheist. He says the atheist is easier to deal with, by the way. But he wants to understand the difference between redemption and salvation, and there is a huge difference, isn't there?
Well, there's a huge difference, and that is that redemption means one thing, and salvation means many, many, many things. Redemption is dealing with the reconciliation between God and man, and the end of the dispute, the cessation of hostilities. That in and of itself is a salvation, but the term salvation is defined and is applicable to the subject that is being talked about. So is redemption a salvation? Yes, it's a tremendous salvation, but the salvation that brought redemption and the salvation that man now needs is drastically different. The salvation that brought us redemption was done completely by the will of God, by the purpose of God, through the plan of God, through the prophets of God, through the will of God, by the work of Christ, by the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Man had nothing to do with redemption. Nothing. No involvement, no suggestions, no votes. No poll was taken. God excluded man so he could include all of man. And that exclusion process, number one, the exclusion process from redemption is vitally important. Let me go through this just a moment. The exclusion process, first off, through the law, to prove that even God's chosen people could not keep the law. He excluded excluded all of them for a sign to the entire world. Don't the entire planet try this, because I've chosen the Jewish people to show you that you can't do it either. And then...
Hold on for a second. That alone is profound. What the church teaches, and as many of you people know, I'm Jewish, and the Jewish people are known as the chosen people, chosen by God to have a special covenant. What you're saying is that God, yes, the Jews are chosen, but they're chosen to show that no race of people, no individual person, could possibly keep enough rules and regulations to earn righteousness with God.
Or to keep any covenant with God. And this is and it is big, and I know this is one of the things that I am so grateful for to the Jewish people. But the Jewish people were chosen to fail, because fail they did. Now, that's not an insult to them. They should be revered for their role in bringing about the revelation of the work of God to this earth. Because the conclusion of the prophet to the Jewish people and to the whole world was, there is none righteous, no, not one. So God set forth a plan, and it was not a plan of redemption. There was only one plan of redemption. There's people have said that that Jesus was plan B. No, Jesus was always the only plan of redemption. The law was never a plan of redemption. It was a plan to show through the Jewish people that no one, even by God speaking to them, by God giving them his own rules and regulations, and his own covenants, and speaking and relating to them as personally as he could and getting as close as he could without killing them, because the presence of God to an unrighteous person is death. So God never came in direct contact with Israel. He said, I'll appear in your praises, I'll manifest myself in many ways, but if you even touch the Ark of my Covenant, even the physical representation of me, you're going to die. And a man did die out of the graciousness of his heart, trying to stabilize the Ark of the Covenant from tilting over. So the perfection of God cannot come in contact with imperfection. And that's what the law proved, is that no amount of man's righteousness, even through chosen people, can ever bring the presence of God to dwell in them. They even had to hide God behind a curtain, a veil, in three stages to get to that presence, and then had to, even one person was the only one who could go in, who had to be ceremonially cleansed, or he had dropped dead in that presence. And that was just coming into to more of a symbolic presence of God, more than the presence of God in reality. Then God chose 12 disciples. And those 12 disciples, I know that they're lined up on statues around the courtyard at the Vatican. I've been there. I've seen the 12 apostles on their statues. But I believe that they were chosen for the same reason that Israel was chosen. They are called the 12, they represent the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right.
Now, we know that Israel failed to become righteous through the law. That we know. So does that mean that God failed at his plan, or was that God's plan? Does God not get what he wants, or does God come up with plans that don't work? Is it a failed plan to invade Iraq and then turn them into a democracy? What is God's plan? Is God's plan always successful? Well, I believe God's plan always is successful. But in this case, God's plan was for failure. And failure was exactly rendered to the nation of Israel.
And let us not forget that the initial failure occurred in Adam. God wanted to magnify the failure through the law.
Absolutely, and to make sure that it was portrayed to the mind of man, you can't make it through your own righteousness. And then when the entire planet or the entire Jewish nation was declared to be unrighteous through God's laws, and even the Jewish people would admit they're unrighteous through God's laws, there is no one righteous by keeping the law of God. It's never been done, not just by the Jewish people, but by any group of humans on the face of planet Earth.
Well, the Jews were the only ones that God demanded it of.
Absolutely.
And failed miserably. And, you know, there's a huge controversy within the Jewish community today because, you know, the Jews, they're trying to work it out the best way they know how, but there are some Jews that are honest enough, very religious Jews, that say, we can't do this because the temple doesn't exist anymore.
Yes.
And so they want to build another temple.
Yes, and there's that radical element that is trying to bring that back into existence. And, you know, great, you know, at least somebody is acknowledging the requirements at least.
Exactly, exactly.
Rushing it off to the side. So maybe if we come back again full circles trying to do it, maybe again we will realize that it can't be done. But then we have 12 disciples. You know that this is where that Jesus' issue comes up with belief. He required these guys to believe. And he performed miracles. He healed the sick, cleansed the leper, raised the dead, cast out devils. He even entreated them to walk on water with him. He even rose from the dead and presented himself to them. They were still in unbelief. So when God, excluded everyone from redemption through works, performance, or belief, that's when that salvation took place for the entire human race. But you see, for God to include everybody, he had to exclude everybody. And it's the most powerful point of the process of redemption that the church has missed. They still have some concept that somebody can make it through the rules or even through the belief. There isn't a belief in Jesus or God that is good enough to redeem you.
That's the first rule. You got to believe.
Yes, and now that has become the first rule. You've got to believe. Actually, it was the last rule after the law, after it had been proven that nobody could keep the law. Mm-hmm. Then Jesus said, okay, let's back up and let's just require you to believe.
And when the churches, Michael, teach the book of Acts and say that this is for us today, that God will pour out his spirit upon all flesh in the last days, and these examples, they don't say, by the way, you know, they were the guys in the book of Acts are still sacrificing animals at the temple. We need to go back to that too.
Yeah, well, they sure don't pull up all the other things.
They just conveniently forget the things like Paul having Timothy circumcised. We'll just put that one aside.
Yeah.
But we'll take these cloths, and for a love gift of $100 or more, we'll send you a prayer cloth.
Yes.
Because we're going to pull out that one scripture, that one little story in the book of Acts, and we're going to make thousands upon thousands of dollars on that concept.
Yeah, and why not purification rites? They required Paul to go through it, along with five other people, to prove. Now, let me state, the reason they wanted Paul to go through purification rites is to prove that his belief that in grace and that the law was no longer in effect wasn't true. That is exactly what James told him. Peter and James told him, we want you to go through this purification rites to prove to the people that the things that you say about grace are not true. And so we don't go back to those. But that's exactly what we're doing by imploring any element of law is the issue of falling completely back under the law. And so that, you know, we wind up with the issue. This is the fact. This is the difference in salvation and redemption. Salvation is applicable. If I, you know, and I've used this example many times, Glenn, if you and I were standing on the street corner yakking, which is what we'd be doing if we were together, incessantly to the point where we hardly knew where we were,
yes.
and I started to step off the curb, and you saw a bus coming, and you reach and grab my arm, you saved me.
Mm-hmm.
That's salvation. That doesn't mean you got me into heaven. That means you got me out of the way of the bus.
Right.
You see, salvation is applicable to the subject at hand. You know, if somebody calls right at the last minute before a disaster takes place, that's salvation. If you are at the last minute able to pay your rent before the penalties are applied, that's a salvation. And yes, salvation pertaining to redemption is the greatest salvation, but the salvation that Paul speaks of, because Paul knows the salvation that brought redemption has already been completely resolved between God and Jesus, excluding the will of man, then Paul teaches a salvation then that is of the mind and the soul. And it's the thing that Paul constantly prayed for and hoped for, is the saving of the soul and the renewing of the mind. The renewing of the mind is salvation. If you begin to agree that gravity is real, you just got saved.
Mm-hmm.
You got saved from falling off of a building and splatting by experience. You don't have to do it by experience. You got saved by knowledge that you don't have to go through the process to find out. So salvation, again, is a term that is expressive to the subject that it is applicable to, whatever it's applied to. You know, you can get in a snowstorm and somebody come by, you know, when you run out of gas, you got saved. But it doesn't mean you're going to heaven. It means you don't have to sit in a cold car.
Right.
So, you know, I could beleaguer this point until...
regarding the redemption of all humanity, salvation is the ongoing understanding that you're redeemed.
Yes, that is what the salvation that Paul speaks of now. The salvation that brought redemption is not the salvation that we need, because that salvation has already taken place. That's the reason there's such a controversy, you know, between the Pentecostals and the Baptists, is that they believe that they're trying to figure out, is salvation something that you get just once, or what is this ongoing
right.
salvation?
Once saved, always saved.
Yes. So, and that's what's created this controversy, Glenn, is because both are in the Bible. There is a salvation that's spoken of that's absolute and once and for all. And then there's a salvation that's spoken of that is continuous. But you see, instead of taking polar opposite differences, I agree with both, except neither agree with the fact that redemption was for the whole world.
Right.
It's the only thing that resolves the issue of Paul's teaching about a salvation that is instantaneous and complete without the will of man, and a salvation that is ongoing.
See, when you tune into this webcast, ladies and gentlemen, this is a salvation moment. It's the Bible calls it the renewing of the mind. Our mind needs to come into alignment with what God thinks of us. And God thinks that you're righteous. And God is not upset with you. The ongoing understanding of Christ and Christ crucified. So Paul said, he said, Michael, he wants to know nothing save Christ and Christ crucified.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, I have to tell you a funny moment about this whole issue of being saved, and it was during the time when Pat Robertson was running for president, and he and I were sharing a platform in northern Illinois, and I shared my platform time, my speaking time with Pat Robertson to do a political campaign, and of course, you know, the media flooded in and everybody came in. But Pat Robertson and I were in the guest speaker's lounge, actually where you could peep through a hole, and it looked like a gun slot, you know, that you could see through out onto the platform and see everything that's going on. And there was nobody back there but myself and Pat Robertson. And so I while we were sitting there talking, just he and I asked him about I asked him something about Jesse Jackson, because Jesse Jackson, you know, of course, is a professing believer. And I remember so clearly Pat Robertson chuckling and looking at me, and he said, "Mike," he said, "Jesse just needs to get saved."
Well, you know, when I was still trying to incorporate the gospel, this gospel, in a church setting, and Saturday, we used to have our meetings on Saturday. Saturday after Saturday after Saturday, I was preaching the gospel. And it was lifting people's hearts, and people were getting so freed up in their hearts. But at some point, that Pharisaical mindset set in, which was, okay, we get this. Now let's move on. As if there's some higher understanding or some higher revelation than Christ and Christ crucified.
Yeah, no, that's so true. Because, you know, the salvation, and what they're really wanting is the salvation that can only come by the revelation and the true understanding of the gospel. They want something more, which I understand that in part, because what they're wanting to know is, how does this gospel affect my daily life?
Right. How do I get healed? How do I get rich? How do I save my marriage? How do I raise good kids?
And they're wanting some spiritual application to it. But this is the issue of freedom. And the spiritual application to the redemptive work of the cross is, you're free to make your choices.
Right, exactly.
And in the power of those choices, you can do as great and be as great of a parent or whatever it is that you choose to be. You have this treasure in earthen vessels. Your decisions count. Your decisions are powerful. Your will now means something. But you see, in evangelical Christianity, we apply the will to that huge spiritual thing of whether or not we're going to heaven or not, and then make our personal will something that is, we're trying to yield to something else and defer whether or not we make a decision, turn right or left at Oak Street, to God.
Right.
Well, God doesn't care whether you turn right or left at Oak Street. Do whatever you want. Make your choices, but make them out of the revelation that you are absolutely one with God. You're a holy, righteous person who is perfect in the eyes of God. You can fail, you can achieve, you can do nothing with your life. Sit down and quit if you want. But you see, that's where, Glenn, that I am persuaded that the revelation of this gospel will kick you in the butt and say, do something with your life. If you don't want to, that's fine too. But no, it's your choice.
Exactly. And regardless of if a person thinks that God does care if they turn right or left on Oak Street, it doesn't affect how he views you.
Absolutely.
Your righteousness is as solid as that tree that Jesus hung on, as cleansing as the blood of Christ. And I want to thank Mike, who followed up his question to let us know that he's listening in Southern California. Sounds pretty good, Mike. Although
I was concerned we'd gotten a little carried away there, sounds like we got to it.
Yeah, which I appreciate. And now, this is a question from Leah in British Columbia, and it's quite a long letter, Mike, and I'm going to get to the heart of it. She's frustrated. She's ticked off. She's watching her children being judged by the church, that they're not going to heaven, that they're not right with God, that they need to get right with God. She says, "I just hate the fact that my kids are judged." And this is written out of a mother's love. She says, "They're being judged by self-righteous people. How do I deal with attitudes like this coming from all directions? Do you share these things with your children? And do they know the difference between what you used to preach and what you preach now?" Leah, I can say, yes, absolutely. My six children can state it verbatim. They totally understand. But Michael, how do you deal with kids that were in the church and who are now out of the church? How do you explain this to them? And also, how do parents deal with their children being judged when they know that they are righteous before God?
Well, believe me, from the experience that I've had with parents who have children who have been under legalism of their parents, one of the most bonding moments that you'll ever have is to go to your child and say, I was wrong. You are righteous, holy kids. It doesn't mean you're not going to go in timeout. Doesn't mean you're not going to have your driving privileges suspended. It doesn't mean I'm not going to be bringing down the wrath of mom or the wrath of dad on you occasionally. But you need to understand that in God's sight, you're absolutely perfect. Believe me, in the cases that I've dealt with, the children are the most grateful to hear that news. Number two, judgment's just a part of this world. I think that the issue, Leah, is not getting to the point to where that you get people to stop judging your children, but to get your children and yourself to embrace the full reality that no one's judgment can surpass the judgment of God. Now, judgment does not necessarily mean something bad's going to happen. Judgment means a verdict. And the verdict is in, Leah. Your children are holy. Your children are righteous. And even the people that are judging your children are holy and righteous. And even their children are holy and righteous. The power of this gospel is not that we correct the attitudes of everyone who does not understand it, but the fact that their attitudes cannot undermine the confidence that you have that your children are righteous, nor your ability to communicate that to them, and the confidence, again, that you walk in. Let the judgment fly. Let it fly, because it is in the middle of that judgment that is going to make your voice that much stronger in the lives of your children.
That is fantastic. I hope that helps, Leah. Question coming from Pep in Marshfield, Wisconsin, Michael. Pep is a very cerebral person, and he says he believes that this gospel has the power to radically change and unite the world. He says it destroys prideful, exclusive thinking, which divides humanity and reveals our equality in God. Christianity has presented itself to others, meaning the Jewish people, the Muslim people, Hindus, atheists, etc., as simply another exclusive religion. When we talk of this inclusive gospel to people of other mindsets, it's very difficult for them to separate it from the twisted gospel that the institutional church presents. Michael, he wants you to answer this question. Do you believe that this gospel must cause a revolution within the institution of Christianity before it can be embraced by the followers of other religions or ideologies?
I think it can do it either way.
You've had some experience with that, haven't you?
Yes. My hope that the institution of Christianity will ever embrace this has waned. My confidence that this gospel will have its impact regardless has greatly, greatly increased. Because that's exactly what I've seen. That even without the church's validation of this message, it still spreads. It still has its impact. It still does its own duty. As Paul said, the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. Because the gospel is that you're already righteous, and that leads you to a salvation that clarifies life and clarifies humanity, as Pep is pointing out to us. It is given such clarity that you ache. The clarity is so strong, Glenn. The clarity of what the answers are, where there are answers to be had, is so clear that you ache inside for the process of this becoming reality. But the thing that I would say, Pep, is that I agree with Paul. The gospel is the power of God unto salvation. And that power, whatever it is, and I do not even claim to know the gravity of that power. I just know that if it's the power of God, it's got to be pretty intense, okay? Whatever it is, I do not think that any organized religion, Christianity or any other such religion, even though it may be designed to stop it or pervert it, I do not believe that it can possibly detract away from it.
And those that will get it, will get it, and those that won't, will get it eventually. It's the power of God unto salvation to everyone who believes,
yes.
To the Jew first and also to the Gentile. That's everybody, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
The Jew, there's only two groups of people in the Bible, the Jews and the Gentiles. That gospel is the power of God, and everyone who believes, and eventually we believe that this revelation, this salvation of Christ redeeming the world is uncovered to everybody. But recall the story, Mike, I forget where you were having the meeting, but I believe it was a Muslim woman that was sitting in the meeting, and she, do you recall the story?
So far, I don't.
And she, it might have been in Canada, and she had been, you know, had been obviously preached to by Christians. But when she heard you present the gospel, then she understood.
Oh, the Buddhist.
Oh, so she was Buddhist, right?
Yeah, we had a Buddhist, a scientist, and an atheist. It sounded like a joke, you know. And there was a Buddhist, a scientist, and an atheist, and only two parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that really took place. That was actually in Denver. And all three of those people, the Buddhist, the atheist, and the scientist, spoke to me, and he told me, he said, I have never heard anything, and it was my first time of presenting the redemption of the world to a group of people. And the scientist comes up and tells me, I have never heard greater logic applied to any subject as a scientist that I've ever heard in my life. Well, I was bowled over, you know, and then the atheist, of course, everybody there had been listening to Grace, and the atheist was trying to say something. This was after the meeting, days of meeting, and all the people that were around, I was letting them answer the questions. I was wanting to see how my disciples were doing. You know? And they were answering the questions so greatly, but they were being so gracious to this guy that they were answering their questions, his questions, but they were saying, well, man, that's only true if there is a God. So they were giving him the grace to even embrace the possibility there isn't a God.
Right.
And so finally he had to raise his hand and tell him, okay, you guys can stop it. You know, I believe. They gave him so much latitude not to believe, he became a believer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to do. We have to give people the latitude not to believe. You do not make believers by forcing them to. You get Saddam Hussein type of believers.
Right.
And the Jesus believers are those who have no requirement, no threat of punishment for not believing. But you say, but Mike, it's in the Bible. Yes, but you have to read it in the context that those requirements were given to people who failed at it so that we would know that the requirement to believe was no longer a part of the redemption process, because the requirement to believe was before the redemption process took place. And that's what people will not accept. The requirement to keep the law and the requirement to believe both came before redemption was given. Now that redemption is here, doesn't it even at least make sense that it changed the requirement to believe and to keep the law?
Well, and it was not the only requirement that was laid out before the redemption occurred.
Yes.
It was just the one that is the most convenient and the easiest to enforce.
Oh, no, we had 637 other laws.
Well, and then Jesus also said you should cut off your hand and pluck out your eye and give everything away to the poor.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And
I'm the poor, if anybody still believes that. If you're trying to get into heaven, give me your money.
And
we'll let you know after you give me the money. You didn't have to do that.
And even if you know you are already going to heaven, we appreciate your gifts and contributions.
Usually is appreciated.
Exactly right. Well, we've got a couple more questions, but we're going to save those for next week. We've got people writing in from Atlanta asking about the wrath of God being poured out in the book of Revelation. And we also have a question on the tithe we'll get to from somebody from Miami next week. But the time goes by so fast, and we do have good questions and people really interested, Michael. And as always, we appreciate your time and your insight and the amount of time that you have spent to mine this information out of the Bible. It's just you can't put a dollar figure on it, but we do appreciate people contributing and to the degree that they're able to.
Yes, we do appreciate it, and it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we're going to do it again next week, Wednesday the 13th, and same time, same website, Glenn Klein Online. Have a great week. You can email us your questions during the course of the week at webcast@gospelrevolution.com, and then just listen for the answers. We archive all the programs. This one will be archived as well in the next couple of days. So stay tuned to gospelrevolution.com, and have a great week. Be safe out there. We love you. And yes, we're saved. We're redeemed. This is the gospel. This is the good news. It's not just the gospel we share. It is the true gospel. This is Glenn Klein Online, thanking Patrick Jones for all his hard work, engineering and producing the program. Shalom, everybody!